We still do 7 NUFC Matters show a week for free. But if you want to help support NUFC Matters, then there are a few ways of doing it. Hit the like button on each live broadcast and video. This helps the channel grow. Hit the subscribe button and select the all notifications bell so you don't miss a single show. If you want to help us financially, then you can join the channel using this button with the membership starting at $1.99 a month. Or you can drop us a donation in the chat using a super sticker. We're also looking for sponsors. If you'd like your brand advertised on the flyers for the show and featured during the ad break, then email John at nufcmatters.com to arrange today. Good morning, welcome to NUFC Matters with me, Steve Wraith. Delighted to welcome friend of the show, Ben Jacobs, back. How are you, Ben?
Good morning, everything good. How are you?
Oh, good, mate. Is that a football-related jumper?
No.
People do like your jumpers on here.
Yeah, I say, if I move up slightly, Harry Potter-related jumper.
Ah, Harry Potter. There we go. So that's because that saves the questions, which will inevitably turn up in the chat. What is Ben's jumper? But it's, it looks like a Wolves kind of top, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of Wolves-coloured. It's Hufflepuff, which apparently is my house.
All right, there we go then. There we go.
Someone will learn about it. So
well, that's good. That's Slytherin, isn't it? I think, yeah. Okay, plenty to talk about in this next hour. I am going to start with your club, Ben. I know you're a Newcastle United supporter in your second club, but Leicester City. We've been following this with interest on NUFC Matters. Ian says, morning, elephant in the room. Can you explain Leicester's charges and their legal action against the Premier League in less than 30 minutes? But that's the hard part. And Phil Scott on Twitter says, is Leicester's case purely about the club's issues, or is there a chance it could become widespread to anti-competitive and cartel behaviour? So plenty to digest on that one, Ben.
Yeah, I'm not sure I could explain the colour of the sky in less than 30 minutes, let alone Leicester's financial charges. So good luck, everybody.
Yeah, you know, I mean, what's going on, mate? What is going on? I mean, this is tragic. This Leicester have had a bit of a slump in form. They've led the division all season, had a big slump in form, and now we learn that they're potentially going to be, you know, deducted points when they come back into the Premier League. If they come back into the Premier League, the way things are going, they could end up in the playoffs. It's not a given at the moment, but this is a strange case, Ben.
Yeah, we all know profit and sustainability, and obviously the EFL have an equivalent. So in the Premier League, over a three-year monitoring period, you can lose 105 million. In the EFL, it drops to 35. But when you come down or conversely go up, the figures become adjusted. So Nottingham Forest was just over 60 million, and Leicester's allowable losses in the current monitoring cycle that we're in are 83 million pounds. And that factors in coming down from the Premier League, but having to align yourself with the EFL allowable losses. So the oddity in all of this is that the teams that have been charged previously by the Premier League have been in the Premier League at the time and earlier, and Leicester have a combination of things to deal with, one from the Premier League, which are listed charges, and two from the EFL, who have placed them under a transfers embargo. So there's two perspectives from Leicester that will lead to counter action. One is against the Premier League over jurisdiction. Do they have the right to pursue a charge against Leicester now, or do they have to wait until the eventuality where they get promoted? And then the EFL have placed Leicester under a transfer embargo, which is the protocol under the rules. But Leicester's counter argument in their second case will no doubt be, as they kind of alluded to in the statement, that the financial year has not been completed and Leicester are nonetheless being accused of being in breach based on a projection, yes, by an independent panel, but it was done in November. So I think Leicester argue if you've got a quarter of the financial year left and they could be up for the time the financial year ends on the 30th of June and they can have had the ability to sell some players, how can you really project on their finances? Because the club can always, if they need to, sell to try and balance things and avoid a punishment. So I sense that you have a very interesting situation now, which will be defined by speed. Because if the Premier League pursue these charges and Leicester go up, then the presumption would be that they would start next season with a points deduction. If the Premier League pursue these charges and Leicester don't go up, then Leicester may argue there's no jurisdiction. If the EFL take on these charges, because you won't get double jeopardy, you won't get a dual punishment whereby EFL punish you if Leicester don't go up, and then the following season, if Leicester do go up, you get a secondary punishment. So there's going to have to be some alignment between EFL and Premier League. And this is what Leicester are arguing. Who actually has the right now to charge us? Is it the Premier League or is it the EFL? And if it's the EFL, then Leicester say you've got to wait for the financial year to shut. If it's the Premier League based on historical things, then why have they waited until now? But Leicester's primary concern, in very basic terms, taking the legalities out of it, will be to avoid a points deduction incoming between now and the end of the season. And I think it's unlikely because there's almost no time left. And Leicester would have the right to appeal as well. And you'd have to resolve it and very fast, because you can't even wait until the off season, because you need to know if Leicester are up, if they're automatically up, if they're in the playoffs. And what if there was a speculative number hanging over the club and the season ends? How do you start the playoffs? So I think it is very unlikely, unless it's incredibly expedited, that anything will happen this season. And I think it's almost certainly not going to be the case now, which is why Leicester have counterfiled, because counterfiling eats up time. It's legally permissible. So they get to the end of the season. And then obviously, if they go up, the EFL can back off and the Premier League would have jurisdiction. And at that point, it may be the case, if Leicester are proven to be in breach by the independent panel, that they start next season if they're in the Premier League with a points deduction. But the primary concern of the club is essentially to not have this double jeopardy where they're fighting EFL and Premier League, to define the jurisdiction and the right time for a hearing, and ultimately to make sure that there isn't a points deduction between now and the end of this season.
Interesting questions coming in. DXK says, Ben, is there any chance the other 14 could revolt against these PRS FFP rules as anti-competition?
No, I don't think so. The first thing is the rules are there to protect the clubs. I think it's really easy to say that they're somehow unfair and that clubs are being penalised and it's tragic and the rules are outdated. But the reality of the situation, in my view anyway, is that the market is inflated. And there's a difference between bad rules and rules that become tougher in light of a market that's gone crazy. So if I'd have said to you 5 years ago, even, that your club wants to spend 200 plus million or even 350 million like Chelsea, most would have said that's insane. We could get 6, 7, 8 players and we don't need to spend that amount of money. Now the feeling is if you want 2 or 3 top players, you may have to spend 200 plus million. Anyone that wants Bruno Guimaraes, 100 plus million. Anybody that wants even players like Miguel Almiron or Callum Wilson or Kieran Trippier, all top players, but for various reasons, either slightly out of form or in their early 30s, the number's still well in excess of 20 million quid. So the market's gone crazy. And if you want 4 or 5 players, you're not at Premier League level going to get that for under, let's just call it 105 million, which is the amount that you're allowed to lose over a 3-year monitoring period. So you've either got to have excellent outgoings or you've got to stagger your recruitment. And the rules makers would argue that's there to protect the clubs and the market has to deflate. And then there'll be a parity between the rules and the spending. But if clubs continue to insist that they need to spend 200, 300 million within a window or even over a 3-year cycle, it becomes very, very difficult under the rules. But that doesn't mean that the rules are necessarily wrong. It just means that the rules were made at a time when the market wasn't inflated and they're there to protect the clubs. So when you're asking the question, could the clubs revolt and is it anti-competitive? It isn't, because it makes the clubs sustainable. And also, the clubs voted for this. The clubs agreed to this. And that's sometimes the thing that we forget under profit and sustainability. So what may happen is the clubs may look at the inflated market and say, we'd like to put ourselves at a bit more risk, and we'd like to be able to spend more, and we'd like to have a little bit more leeway, and we'd like to align ourselves with financial fair play, which means the so-called squad cost limit. So there's a ratio between what you can spend and what you can bring in. And of course, that has huge benefit to the bigger clubs with large revenue, and it creates more of a gulf between big and small within the Premier League. So there'll be some opposition to that. But I think the majority of the clubs, if you only need a two-thirds majority to pass, will like the idea of aligning the Premier League spending rules with the UEFA ones. And that would give just a little bit more leeway. And it makes sense. But once again, I wouldn't be billing the rules as somehow too strict, too unfair, too cruel, too tragic. The clubs voted for this. And they voted for this because on paper at the time when they voted for this, it looked sustainable. But now we've moved into such a hyperdrive market driven by Chelsea, driven even by Arsenal buying players like Declan Rice or Kai Havertz for, on paper at least, above their market value, despite the fact that they're top, top players. And now we're in a situation where 300 million or 200 million in a single window doesn't raise an eyebrow. And everyone just thinks it's the norm. And no one can understand why, if a player that they like and they're told even at 50 million or 75 million is a bargain, no one can understand why, if that's value, their club can't proceed. How on earth, how dare the rules prevent us from signing that 70 million pound player that we're told is amazing, that's young, that's valuable? Why can't we move? It's exactly what we need. And of course, the fans look at it from that point of view because they want the best possible team. But the rules are not only there for a reason. They were voted for by the likes of Newcastle United, Manchester City, Leicester, when they were in the Premier League. All of the charge clubs approved these rules. And now, obviously, they're suddenly saying that they need changing because they're under the threat of penalties. But the bottom line is, if we continue in this spending, you might get that 70 million player in a window. You might even get success from it. You might get Champions League. But over time, the clubs will put themselves in a really perilous position. So the rules are there for a reason. I'm not saying they don't need tweaks. I personally am in favor of aligning them with UEFA because it does give a bit more flexibility. But this isn't about the Premier League creating rules to trip up the clubs and somehow pinch the pennies in a way that makes it unfair or anti-competitive for a club to move in the market. The rules are there in order to protect the clubs from ultimately going bust.
Lots of questions coming in on this, many which can only really be your opinion. Tom Dixon says, Ben, do you think they'll scrap FFP in the future?
Not if we're talking about FFP. FFP, UEFA, profit and sustainability is the domestic Premier League rules that, as I said before, are reflected by the EFL as well. FFP is constantly being adapted, and the new pillars of FFP were only launched about 18 months ago and will be slowly phased in. So that's there to stay. Profit and sustainability, there's a question mark over. And I think that that's partially down to the fact that if the UEFA reforms work, it does make more sense to have the same structure and the same outlook to financial rules and regulations as UEFA, even though obviously not every single club ends up competing in European competitions and under financial fair play. But if there's a connection between financial fair play and profit and sustainability in all of the domestic rules, it puts everyone on a level playing field. And I think that in the Spanish league, the argument of the clubs is essentially that the rules are too strict domestically, and Barcelona and Real Madrid say that effectively Javier Tebas is making it harder for them to compete in Europe because you need to be strong domestically. And then if the financial rules stop you from signing big players and extending big players' contracts and paying higher wages, then you get to a point where you're not going to be as successful in Europe. And they argue that they are in a detrimental position compared to other top European teams because of the domestic financial rules. And then they look at the Premier League and say, compared to La Liga, even under current profit and sustainability, it's just spend, spend, spend. And no wonder Manchester City are winning a Champions League because they've got a lot more leeway than a La Liga club. So I think that would be the argument of some of the other European leagues, that everyone's moaning about profit and sustainability, but it's way more relaxed than La Liga's cost control. And as a consequence, there's an inconsistency. So you have to, if everything connects in a pyramid up to UEFA, have a consistency of domestic rules, which Premier League clubs would say make them more lenient and let clubs be rewarded for their spending in relation to what they bring in. Whereas somebody like Tevez would probably argue that it needs to be even stricter. And he would argue that profit and sustainability is comparatively lenient compared to La Liga. So it's an interesting debate, but financial fair play is here to stay, and rightly so, because we said this, I think, if we come back to Newcastle just for a minute, in the build up to the season, I think I got a lot of stick for it at the time, and people still may disagree, but I said, you don't really change your model when you get one season of Champions League football, and you budget very conservatively. So on the football side, the aim is Champions League, the aim is European football in the second half of the season. The aim is probably top five this season under the presumption that fifth gets Champions League football. That's Eddie Howe's goal, of course, because you want to build on Champions League. But from a budgetary point of view, you don't change your model. And most clubs like Brighton, Newcastle, believe it or not, are budgeting for 10th place, which is not the same as planning for 10th place in the football side. 10th place might get Eddie Howe sacked, but you still budget for 10th place. Because if you over budget, you create a situation where you maybe set yourself up for financial ruin. And I think that this is the whole point. If you relax the rules and you have a Newcastle United situation where you've got one season in Champions League, owners maybe that are slightly less responsible or risk reward or maybe just ambitious could take a massive risk. I think we saw it with Leeds United under David O'Leary many, many years ago, where you spend, spend, spend because you need more depth, you want stars. And ultimately, it feels great at the time. And then, of course, you flash forwards and it's taken away from you. And Newcastle are now in a position where they didn't get Champions League in the second half of this season, and they're not going to get Champions League heading into next season. So if they'd have spent an extra 150 million, they might have put themselves in a position where it all looked rosy at the time. But now they're heading into a season where they may finish with no European football. So next season, they have to budget, therefore, with zero European football. And they could put themselves in a really tricky financial position. And this, again, is why you have to be very careful about relaxing the financial rules, because, of course, some clubs may take advantage of them out of necessity or out of ambition. But flash forwards 12 months, and there could be a situation where that club becomes in a really difficult and unsustainable position. And Newcastle, I think, is a great example, because nobody would have batted an eyelid under PIF when they qualified for Champions League. If the rules were more relaxed and they wanted to spend an extra 100, 150 million, it would have been welcomed, it would have been celebrated. And there's plenty of positions where Eddie Howe would have wanted to strengthen. But now they're absolutely right for budgeting for 10th place for this season, even if, to stress, the football aim is higher. And the reason for that is because if they finish 10th, even though the fans won't like it, from a budgetary point of view, they'll be protected because it's the worst case scenario that they've planned for. If they budgeted for fifth and Champions League again, and if they spent accordingly, and if they gave Howell more money to spend, they'd be in a position now where they'd be in big, big trouble. And this is why the clubs have to respect the rules. And again, to emphasise, they are rules that the clubs voted for.
Yeah. Another question that we've had here is from Roger. Ben, do you think there'll be another rule change or made up to keep us away from the dark magic six? Lots of people, you see, I think really, you know, we had this as a bit of a paranoia situation, I think, surrounding Newcastle fans originally, but more and more people seem to be buying into this, that there has been this kind of protection. Troll says, does Ben think PSR now protect the big six?
Well, let's wait and see on the Man City charges, I guess, first, because they're a member of the big six. And let's wait and see whether anything happens to Chelsea going forwards, because it seems like the Premier League are going after anyone and everybody. But the other thing that we should factor into all of this is the new independent regulator. And I personally don't think it's a coincidence that the Premier League have clamped down over the last year or so. If we go back beyond Everton and Forest to Manchester City and any possibility of Chelsea, who are still being investigated but haven't been charged, if you add all that up, it comes at the same time as the formation of the independent regulator, which has now been put to Parliament as a bill. So are the Premier League showing they can self-regulate to make sure that the dynamic from day one between them and the independent regulator is there, as opposed to doing nothing and then realizing when the independent regulator arrives that that regulator wants to investigate all these clubs and then the Premier League look weak and it appears that they've turned a blind eye? So we're going to have to kind of wait and see what the Premier League approach is. But the good thing, I suppose, about the punishments of PSR in a backhanded way is that, as you can see, if you read the Nottingham Forest case that just came out, it's all kind of ratioed against previous cases and it's all ratioed against losses that go over the allowable ones, leading to a recommended points deduction. So the independent panel, who are not the Premier League, let's remember, so they're not the ones handing out the punishment, the Premier League directly, they refer to an independent panel. And that independent panel seemed to be quite scientific with how they're formulating punishments at the moment. Obviously, we've only got a small sample, but if you look at Everton, then Everton's appeal, then Nottingham Forest, the way they come to the points deduction is relatively rigid and scientific, and it's based upon a formula. So that would suggest, in theory, if Manchester City are found guilty of even a few charges, that the kind of punishment they have points-wise will be ratioed in the same way as Everton and Nottingham Forest. So in a worst-case scenario, you might be looking at 30, 40, 50-point deduction, and we have to wait and see whether any other powers of punishment are utilised. Because remember, it doesn't have to be a points deduction. It could be a relegation. It could be a stripping of trophies. It could be a fine. It could be nothing. But ultimately, if they're going down the points line and they're using the same formula, then you would expect every single club to be on a level playing field, because you can't really give an ad hoc points deduction unless the case is so atypical when you've got other context. Otherwise, these clubs are just going to go straight into appeal and say, why was my points deduction 6 when Nottingham Forest only got 4 and it's a like-for-like charge? And I think that's where the independent panel can be very useful, because it's a step away in terms of its impartiality from the Premier League. In terms of protecting the Big Six, I think the only thing that the Big Six have is collective voting. And when they do that, because a lot of these resolutions only need a two-thirds majority, if you start with 6 and 6 big clubs, it becomes quite easy for them to push things through collectively. That was obviously the same with the Super League. They all decided collectively they wanted to join. They all decided collectively that they wanted to pull out. And when you do it that way, it means that you've got 6 of, some would say 20, but it's not really 6 of 20, because 3 go down and 3 go up. So the newly promoted and obviously the clubs that drop out are kind of anomalies. So how many clubs actually season on season, rule voting on rule voting, how many clubs actually stay in there? I'm sure if you go back 10 years, and I'm just thinking off the top of my head here, but it's probably no more than 12, because different clubs go down, different clubs come up. So if you're the 6 that are always going to be there, and you know that realistically in a 10-year period when you start voting, and some rules are over one season, some are over more than one season that you debate and formulate and vote, they're kind of 6 of 12. And then the other 8 at the time will come and go. There'll be different clubs. So 6 feel like they've almost got tenure. And if they block vote collectively, even though they're rivals on the field, that can be very powerful. If they end up determining it's better to ratio what you can spend based off revenue that you make, then that will be a clear advantage to the Big Six, but maybe also Newcastle United and a few other clubs as well, because revenues for the Big Six will be higher. And therefore, they will naturally be able to spend more. And smaller clubs will argue that it creates a situation where a newly promoted club like Luton, in that first season, who's got their work cut out trying to stay up anyway, is never going to get anywhere near a Big Six team if it moves from PSR to a squad cost control limit, as it's known under UEFA. And my only fear is that the big six under that model will not only be able to spend more because they make more in very simple terms, but in addition, they will inflate the market further because they'll pay whatever they need to get whoever they need because they'll know that it's within the rules. And then suddenly when Luton Town try and get a midfielder as a new Premier League club, particularly if they go to the foreign market won't distinguish between Luton and Manchester City, potentially, not if there's demand for their player. They'll say, you're a Premier League club. You've just got promoted. You've got a load of TV money. You're already above us because it's not a level playing field, financially speaking. So we expect you to pay 30, 40, 50 million as well. And then if Luton go down paying that money, whether they can afford it at the time or not, their revenue will decrease and they can have a situation where they're walking a financial tightrope. And I think that we always used to say promotion comes with this glory. The playoff finals, the most expensive game in football, was always the kind of glib headline to it. And coming up's amazing. You get TV money and you get all manner of other things. And it's true to an extent. But if you come up and then go down immediately, for a club like Luton, even for a club like Burnley, who have kind of yo-yoed a little bit, I think that's more damaging now. I think it's more damaging to a club to come up and go straight back down financially than it's ever been. And for those that are a bit older, you may remember Swindon Town or Bradford City, who came up, had a fight, and look at them now. They're way, way down the pyramid. And it was actually detrimental to those clubs to come up, because then when they fell down, they were in a position where players didn't want to leave. They had big wage bills and they dropped right down the pyramid. And they've never really recovered. Even a club like Sheffield Wednesday, in my opinion, has never really fully recovered. And hopefully now we'll see them slowly start to get back. Took Sheffield United, took Middlesbrough and other clubs like that. A really long period. Think back, I know Newcastle fans will love this, but think back to that story where Leicester beat them in the League Cup, they lost in the FA Cup final, they had Juninho, they had Ravanelli, they went down. Took them absolutely ages to stabilise because, again, they had spent, and they weren't planning for the situation, and now they've been set back. And I think that it can take you well over a decade to recover. And some clubs don't recover. So that's my only fear with all of this, that if you change the rules from profit and sustainability to a ratio of spend based on what you earn, then there's a huge disparity between a newly promoted club and a big six, and it will benefit the bigger clubs. And I think that it will put the smaller clubs in a really difficult position, maybe an impossible position, because they'll have to spend. They'll know the rules allow them to spend, but it's so risk reward, because if they spend and they don't stay up, then they may put themselves in a position where they never come back up to the Premier League again, in some cases anyway.
Yes, it's ongoing. Lots more questions to get through in the chat. We'll have a quick break and we'll be back after this. A big thanks to all our sponsors, Skips and Bins. Go to their website, skipsandbins.com. Email inquiries at skipsandbins.com or telephone 0800 25 45 25 3. Easy contract free and pay-as-you-go waste collection. Thanks to Mr. Vicky's Sauces, handmade in Cumbria. Go to their website, mrvickys.co.uk. Email info@mrvickys.co.uk or telephone 01768 210102. Thanks to United Group Travel. Go to their website, unitedgrouptravel.com. Email info@unitedgrouptravel.com or phone 01670 632 460 or mobile 0791 666 4174. They're a local company from Morpeth and they're no strangers on our tours, just friends you haven't met yet. Big thanks to Media Arts for all the help with the video side of things. And if you want to subscribe to the channel, hit the subscribe button under the video, click the thumb up to like the video, and click share to share to your social media. If you want to help the channel financially, you can pay a one-off £25 fee. You get a cup, a scarf, a pen, and a membership card and entry into the NUFC Matters monthly draw. Email john@nufcmatters.com for more details. Or if you've got a smartphone, scan the QR code now and it takes you straight to the membership pack. We also support the food bank on this channel. Go to nufcfansfoodbank.co.uk and you'll find the Matchday Bucket. You can make a donation virtually today. You can also find us on iTunes, Spotify, and other podcast providers. We also do events during the year. NUFC Matters Live will be at the O2 City Hall on Friday, the 2nd of August, for an evening with Rob Lee, One Night in Antwerp. Tickets start at £15, and you can get them from ticketmaster.co.uk. An evening with the entertainers takes place on Friday, the 24th of January, 2025, at the Tyne Theatre and Opera House in Newcastle. Telephone 0844 249 1000 or visit the website tynetheatreandoperahouse.uk to buy tickets today. You can also catch me on the North East Footy Breakfast Show, live on Tune Radio, weekdays 7 till 9 a.m. on DAB, smart speakers, and thetuneuk.com. And don't forget, we've got the NUFC Matters End of Season Party. Ben, you're more than welcome to come.
I'll be there.
20th of July, it's in aid of Dementia Matters in the Northeast. We've got Super Matt and Gibbo doing a live talk in Ask George. Is going to take to the stage. And we've got an acoustic set with Trevor and Gaz. And I think Ian is going to come along now from the Long Sands, of course, who do our theme music. They're going to come along and regroup in aid of Dementia Matters, a charity in the Northeast. Tickets are a tenner and all proceeds going to the charity. NewcastleLegends.com or NUFCMatters.com for your tickets. And an evening with Peter Beardsley as well. He was on a podcast with Alan Shearer this week. Fantastic watch if you get a chance to see it. Tickets available now on Woucher for an evening with Peter Beardsley in June. Okay, let's get back to the questions and let's change around a little bit. Barry asked a question. He says, what's your opinion on Man United's Wembley of the North idea? Do you think this will ever get anywhere? What Sir Jim Ratcliffe's asking the government to fund?
Yeah, I think it will get somewhere. I'm not convinced that it will be government funding. Manchester United are quite clear. They're not looking for handouts. So they'll either get some private investment, they'll generate the investment themselves, or there might be elements of public-private funding that are available. Because remember, anything around the stadium fits into the wider Trafford development, which is quite smart from Ratcliffe. And I think that he set the right tone from day one, talking about a Wembley of the North and exploring it. And they've obviously got this task force now, including Gary Neville. And I think even Newcastle fans will agree that a Wembley of the North makes a lot of sense. They no doubt hope that it would be St. James's Park in some capacity. But I think Ratcliffe's point is fair. Why does everything have to be in the capital? Why, for example, would an FA Cup semi-final be at Wembley? Now, if you're Coventry and you're there, you're probably saying, brilliant. But for most teams like Chelsea, Manchester City, even Newcastle these days, to go to Wembley twice for a semi-final and a final, why not have other options? Why not do what they always used to do and try and pick a location that's halfway? It was funny because I mentioned about Leicester beating Middlesbrough. And slightly younger viewers may not realise that when Leicester beat Middlesbrough, it went to a replay. The first one was at Wembley. The second one was at Hillsborough. And they went to Hillsborough because the feeling was that it was kind of unfair, particularly on the Borough fans, to make them come twice in a short space of time down to Wembley Stadium. And we just have this default of it's the national stadium, it's London. But you could effectively have a national stadium up north, or a series of other options. So I think Ratcliffe's very smart to want to build something that ticks that box. I also think that his logic is there will be non-sports income, like music concerts, and there'll be non-football income because NFL, and if you build around the stadium, maybe there's an indoor facility, maybe you can have a basketball court or an ice hockey arena. Everything can kind of connect. So it benefits Manchester United and it benefits the community as well. And I see absolutely nothing wrong with it other than how are you going to fund it? And if you can't fund it, if you're not going to get a handout, which is something, again, Manchester United say they're not looking for, you may have to explore other options. So they've not taken renovation off the table, but they've just made it clear that their preference is to build behind the Stretford end, so a new stadium, but in the same location. And they're very lucky in that sense because Chelsea could knock down Stamford Bridge and build on the spot, but the land is still a little bit restrictive in terms of space. So in an ideal world, if Chelsea built a new stadium, they'd love to find somewhere close where they could build. But Earl's Court, for example, have said a very hard no at the moment. So not every football club can just build a new stadium and have it right next to their old stadium. And it's so smooth in terms of transition if you do it that way, because if you build behind the Stretford end and a brand new stadium, you play at Old Trafford until that stadium is ready, and then you take four or five steps and you go into your new stadium. And it's, transitionally speaking, very easy. But the key question is, can you actually afford that kind of outlay, especially under these financial rules? And also, who's going to pay for it if you can't find the private funding? Because Ineos is still only the minority investor. A new stadium is not a football-only decision. And Ineos and Sir Jim Ratcliffe have got sporting control. So are the Glazers going to dip into their own pocket? And if not, how are you going to get this probably £2 billion or thereabouts to actually get the project off the ground? So we're in that period now where you hear a lot about it, but it's not going to happen overnight. First of all, they need to decide if they're definitely going to build or if they're going to renovate. Then they need to decide how they're going to fund it. Then they need to speak to the fan base and obviously get all the planning permissions, which is why on the task force, they've got lots of council people and fan representatives. And then from there, they need to work out a timescale. And I think at the earliest, even if you're able to start that today, all of that talking part and planning part is going to take well over a year. And then you still have to decide when you can actually have it built by. And I think a new stadium would take 4 or 5 years potentially to build. The Tottenham Hotspur Stadium was a little bit quicker, but most new stadiums are likely to take 4 or 5 years from when you actually get the planning permission to when it can actually open. So I'd be surprised if Manchester United could get this off the ground before, let's say, 2030. And it's encouraging. They're saying all the right things, but now they need to work out whether practically the things they're saying are possible.
Okay, trying to mix it up a little bit just so we're not focusing on one subject at all. Stephen Anderson says, are you still wanting to interview the head of PIF and have you tried to make contact? And just tying it in, there was another question, I think, if I can find it, about PIF. Ah, yeah, Roger. How annoyed are PIF that they can't invest properly in the Newcastle business? So, yeah, two questions on PIF there.
Yeah, I don't think PIF think that they've not invested properly in the Newcastle business. I think that they're the ones setting the budget that I spoke about earlier, and that is conservative. So the PIF plan was to get Newcastle into the Champions League in 3 to 5 years. And they went from almost getting relegated or looking in threat of relegation in January of that season to Champions League the following year. So they'll feel like they've got a good return on their investment, and they'll be well aware that they can't do it in one window. Just because PIF are rich on paper, it doesn't mean they're frustrated that they can't dump a load of money into Newcastle United. They're rich and their wider business is successful because they're sustainable in everything that they do. So I don't think PIF feel anything other than they're ahead of the curve at the moment, which is why they could well just stick with Eddie Howe and look at this season as consolidation, even if they finish outside of the European places, because last season was maybe above their expectations. And as a result, this isn't really about PIF wondering why they can't just walk into Newcastle and drop a bunch of money. And hindsight shows us that, by the way, because when they first came in, the margins for Newcastle spending were greater at that point, and they spent, but not recklessly, and they could have done at that time. And then when they qualified for Champions League, they were heading into this season, and the books for Newcastle this season will be, I would imagine, reasonably healthy, because when we get to the financial cutoff, they've not gone crazy with spending. It's true that they need a couple of outgoings, but they've still got time. But they have had a season, or half a season anyway, with Champions League income. So I think that will reflect relatively strongly on the books. And I think Newcastle will be within profit and sustainability. It might be relatively tight, but I think they'll be okay with the situation. So I'm not so sure that PIF will be frustrated by not being able to invest in Newcastle United. I think they'll argue that that's exactly what they've done on their timescale. It's just that the perspective of investment looks skewed because they did so well last season that the bar on the football side and the demand for success from the fan side has raised significantly to the point where this season feels underwhelming. But I bet you from a strategy point of view and a budgetary point of view, PIF are pretty much exactly where they always planned to be, because they didn't think they'd get Champions League football this early. Regarding speaking to people from PIF, obviously every journalist is looking for interviews and access and content. And if you can get the names on record, brilliant. And I've said many times that it would be great if somebody from PIF, specifically Yasser Al-Rumian, can speak and chooses to speak, then brilliant. We're not entitled to any name, and it's relatively rare that owners and chairmen speak on the record, but you're working to develop trust and relationships. And if the time comes where they're willing to speak, then brilliant. We've got no God-given right, but the less they speak, the more the questioning will deflect to Eddie Howe, and not every question will he be the best position to answer. So eventually you get a situation where a frustration may grow that there's no accountability or transparency from the Newcastle ownership. And it's sort of interesting because I think we as media, whether rightly or wrongly, still are of the belief, the majority of us anyway, I don't think I have the right to speak for other journalists, but I think I've had enough conversations with those that cover Newcastle United or that have been invested in Newcastle United to conclude that when the takeover happened, it was Newcastle pushing in all of their statements transparency. Newcastle wanted all the hearings to be public if they could. In all the statements, they spoke about PIF having nothing to hide. And then they've come in and the transparency has completely disappeared, in my opinion anyway. And that's a bit disappointing. It's not a criticism of the Rubin brothers or Amanda Staveley or what the club have done with their fan base or how they've invested in the community or the unity in the dressing room. I think PIF and others at the club have done a lot right. I love the fact that they're promoting and developing the women's team as well. But when you push transparency that hard and then you don't speak publicly to the media, and then you contrast that to Jim Ratcliffe, who pushed transparency quite hard and on day one spoke to the media, I personally don't understand why Yasser Al-Rumian doesn't at least once face the media transparently, as was promised, and answer our questions. He may have good reasons. He may not feel the need. He may feel that transparency was only necessary in a takeover, and now they own the club. They run it like every other business, and they're not transparent in lots of other areas of PIF. So why do they have to speak to Ben Jacobs or any other person within the media? And that's fine. But I do think it's disappointing for the fan base that the only time they've heard from Yasser Al-Rumian is via a club interview, and there's not much scrutiny or transparency in areas. And if every member of the fan base listed what they want to know from Yasser Al-Rumian, then there'd probably be a lot that's still uncovered. So I think we have to wait and we have to earn that trust. And luckily for me, I lived out in the Middle East. I went over to Saudi Arabia many times. I have interviewed Yasser Al-Rumian before during his time at the Saudi Golf Federation. So I feel like if there ever became a scenario where Newcastle's ownership chose to speak, I would hope that I would have some kind of inclusion in that, whether a one-on-one for broadcast or whether being able to attend at a press conference. But at the moment, they don't have the appetite to do it. And with any contact that you want, you have to respect that. And also, you can't keep asking the same thing over and over again. Can I interview you? Can I interview you? You have to respect the channels. And even if you've got direct access, you still have to make sure that you go through the right channels. They might have a personal secretary. They might have a PIF media office. Newcastle have got a media office. You can't go behind anyone's back with these kind of things. So you have to respect that it's not just Yasser Al-Rumian. He's being advised by his own people, by the club people. And when the time is right, he may speak. And everyone is well aware, not just for me, but for many journalists, that if he's prepared to speak, there's a long, long queue that are waiting. So you can't keep bugging people with the same request when you know that the answer is going to be a no at this stage. But hopefully in the future, it will turn into a yes. And then if I'm fortunate enough to be included, there's plenty of questions that I'd like to ask him.
Couple of Newcastle related questions now, and I'll come to a couple of them just before the end of the show. The one that I wanted to ask was Benny. Ben, is your understanding that we will need to sell a big player by the 30th of June to comply with PSR or not? And I'll add to that. Can you see Newcastle, maybe if they don't qualify for Europe this year, selling an Isak or a Bruno this summer?
Remember, qualifying or not qualifying for Europe this year reflects on the next financial year. So yeah. The 30th of June cutoff is for effectively this season. And Newcastle did have some Champions League windfall. And I suspect if they'd have got out their group, that they wouldn't be particularly worried about the situation. But having only got half a season of Champions League income, they probably do need some outgoings to be totally confident that they're within the rules. And another factor in all of this is that heading into the last monitoring period, of which Newcastle were fine, one of the 3 years was still a COVID-adjusted year, so you've got a lot more leeway. In the next three-year monitoring period, none of the years fall under COVID adjustments, so Newcastle not making the second half of the Champions League could come back to bite them if they don't get an outgoing. And I think we knew from January in attempts, for example, to sell Miguel Almiron, and we know from Eddie Howe speaking publicly, that they will need an outgoing. But I don't think the outgoing is like Chelsea trying for 100 million to both balance the books and spend. I think the outgoing under PSR for Newcastle is a lot smaller than people realise to balance the books. But knowing they then may head into a season with no European football, they won't just be thinking about this monitoring cycle, they'll be thinking about the next monitoring cycle as well. So if Newcastle want to stay within PSR in this cycle, plan for next cycle without European football, and strengthen and spend, which they feel they need to do, that's where they may need a big, big sale. But that's ticking three boxes: spending in the market, being within PSR in this monitoring period, and planning for the next monitoring period. If they were prepared to be more conservative in their spending and they just wanted to make sure they're within 105 million of allowable losses in a three-year monitoring period leading up to the 30th of June this year, then I think the outlay they need to be comfortably within that is probably only 15 or 20 million. And that's where the Trippier fee, the Wilson fee, the Almiron fee, any one of those, if they choose to sell, will make them okay for now. But if they want to go into that inflated market that I spoke about before, that's where they may decide that selling Bruno Guimaraes or Alexander Isak, even though they don't really want to do it, may not only set them up sustainably for the next 2 or 3 years, but it might give them 50, 60 million of that fee to spend in the market. And that might get them one or two players. And they may feel that selling one, being sustainable, being within the rules and bringing in two is a better approach than keeping a player and then sweating on their finances and the need to get European football back over the coming seasons and years.
Okay, got about 15 minutes left. We'll just get through a couple more questions, I think, in that short space of time. Taylor, morning. He says, Ben, do you see any quick wins for Newcastle to close the financial gap, which ties in with what Barry asked as well. Ben, do you think the Toon will ever be in the position where we can compete with Man City financially? What do we need to do sponsorship-wise to get there?
I don't think anyone can compete with Manchester City financially, but let's also see what the 115 charges bring, because maybe there is no competition with Manchester City financially. Maybe they're clear of everyone financially because they've done things in a different way. And some of the financial maneuvers of Manchester City are currently under investigation. And I'm not in any way implying that they're guilty, but we have to wait and see what the 115 charges bring, because if they've gained an advantage financially and they are hypothetically proven guilty, then they're no longer really the yardstick to try and attain to. My feeling is that Liverpool are a good club to look at because they're sustainable, they're well run, they're well planned, they've got a great culture. They can't compete with Manchester City either, but they're still there competing for a Premier League title and succeeding in Europe. So if I was Newcastle, I'd be looking to emulate Liverpool's financial success, not necessarily Manchester City's. And Manchester City are obviously a multi-club group and Newcastle aren't. So Liverpool at this stage for me are the ones to aspire to, because they've got the right culture, the right planning, the right people, And they're still able to spend, but not obviously to the degree and quite anyway, the wage bill of Manchester City. Although if you look at Liverpool's wage bill, it's still really, really high, much higher than Newcastle United's. Quick wins for Newcastle financially would obviously be on the commercial side. Could they, for example, rename or add a sponsor to St. James's Park? And I'm not saying that that would be popular, but there may be some commercial avenues to get quick financial wins where something isn't sponsored and it can just be sponsored. And therefore, that money is just extra money on your books that you never had before. And obviously, the other quick win for Newcastle United is just selling Bruno Guimarães because he's got a release clause. It's 100 plus million. And if anyone was willing to trigger that or pay equivalent to that, and the player wanted to leave and Newcastle were prepared to sell, then suddenly you can pull in 100 million within one window and breathe a lot easier. So sales and sponsorship are probably the two quickest routes for Newcastle United to bring in money.
Okay, and let's get to another question from Roger. He says, any news on our director of football? Obviously, the situation we find ourselves in is that Dan Ashworth's on gardening leave. Manchester United keen on taking him to their club. Newcastle obviously plotting their next appointment. Any rumours on this one, Ben?
Well, I think it's a case of Newcastle dragging on the Ashworth talks a little bit with Manchester United until they firm up a candidate. And once they've got their own candidate, then I think it will be resolved very quickly with Dan Ashworth. And the reason for that is because gardening leave is gardening leave regarding the club, Manchester United, that Ashworth inevitably will end up at. And as long as he's on gardening leave, he can't work for Manchester United. But gardening leave for Newcastle United with Dan Ashworth is paying him. So if Newcastle get in a new sporting director now, then they're paying two sporting directors. They're paying Ashworth his monthly wage and they're paying the new one. And that's not good on the books. So I think as soon as Newcastle lock in a candidate, then we're going to be in a situation where Newcastle want the situation resolved with Ashworth very, very quickly. And it wouldn't remotely surprise me if a compromise is found whereby maybe Ashworth doesn't end up starting in this window for Manchester United, but doesn't miss two windows for Manchester United. So September the 1st feels like the most logical compromise where Manchester United pay less, Newcastle still get an amount and a good amount. They then don't have to pay two lots of wages to Ashworth and to anyone else that's new coming in. And Manchester United can have Ashworth start a little bit sooner, planning for January 2025, but potentially not being involved in this summer. If they want Ashworth for this summer, they're obviously going to have to pay a lot more. And that would also be good for Newcastle financially. But Manchester United at the moment are indicating that they don't want to pay that number, 15, 20, even above 20 million, some are reporting. So I would suspect a compromise will be reached, but I think it's going to be a lot easier and a lot faster for a compromise to be reached once Newcastle have determined who their next sporting director is. I think we can't rule out Paul Mitchell for Newcastle, who obviously used to be at Monaco and was linked as well with Manchester United. And I think that Phil Giles is liked at Brentford as well and is a boyhood Newcastle United fan. In fact, all of his family are. I don't think that's a reason to appoint him, but I think someone working successfully within the Brentford model is the profile that Newcastle would be looking for. They had considered Sam Jewell, but obviously he's off to Chelsea and they were too late to the party on that one. But when you look at the fact that Jewell was at least very loosely discussed, and you also add Giles, who has definitely been discussed, both of them are coming from clubs and one of them directly from the same club as Ashworth, but both of them are coming from models that are similar. And obviously the fact that Newcastle took Ashworth from Brighton, it tells you that that's the kind of profile that they're looking for. Somebody who can step up to a club like Newcastle with a bit more resource, but someone that's also used to finding younger talents and bargains and delving into emerging regions and used to working in a strong culture and used to working with data. And hopefully that leads to more bargains. And hopefully that also allows Newcastle United to compete with the Big Six, because I think Newcastle will argue that they know who the Big Six like And sometimes they will like to compete with a big six club. I think Tonali is a good example, and you pay a big fee. But other times they have to find a player, maybe like Isak is a great example. They also paid a big fee for him, by the way, but they found him in a slightly different region. And I don't think many of the big six were looking there at the same time. And that's where the value of Ashworth comes in. So you need a sporting director, and you find this at the Brentfords, the Brightons and so on, that's maybe used to going to different regions and has got an eye for talent and can find you a younger player that can grow into their price tag, which is exactly what Isak did, which is exactly what Bruno did. And I think that for transition and continuity, if Newcastle can find someone similar in profile to Ashworth, then his departure won't damage the project as much. Whereas if you go for someone, just to put a name out there, not that Newcastle would ever be linked with him, like Campos, who's at PSG, that's the kind of sporting director that wants full autonomy, that wants total control, that wants to bring in their own staff, that wants to start their own culture, that wants to define what they can and can't spend. And you do it their way or the highway. And there's more politics, there's a more maverick element to it, and there's way more autonomy. And I think that's the kind of personality, even if they've got a good track record, that Newcastle are looking to avoid.
We've got three questions left. I want to try and get through them in the next 4 minutes. There's a challenge for you, Ben. Wow. Paul says, Ben, there are Premier League clubs that are running with billions of pounds worth of debt. How is that profit and sustainability?
Well, again, some have got revolving credit. That's a different kind of debt. And some are in debt historically, but you're judged on a monitoring cycle and you can't go back too far historically and punish clubs for things before, for example, rules came into play. So no club is billions in debt under a 3-year monitoring cycle of profit and sustainability. And that is the criteria by which they are being judged. And as a result, there's not much you can do if historically, before these rules came into play, you have a club that was not sustainable or had practices that are in breach of the rules, but before the rules came in. What you can do is allow for investigation, and that's what's happening with Manchester City, and that's what's happening with Chelsea at the moment. And things may come of that, they might not. But it's not strictly true that any club is billions and billions in debt as of now in a current 3-year monitoring cycle. And the sustainability, and it's the same with financial fair play, is about an evolution to get you to a point where you can function outside of debt. And if you keep having monitoring cycles now where you're within allowable losses, then ultimately over a 10-year period or more, you'll start to get yourself on a better financial footing. But I think the question, and a very valid point in what you ask, is a club like Manchester United, who have just borrowed and borrowed and borrowed and borrowed. And cumulatively, even if within each cycle they're okay, cumulatively, they've racked up debt, 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 debt. And that is a very valid point. Should the rules have two monitoring periods, one over 3 years, which is ongoing, and then maybe one over 10 years? So what you can't do is go 104 million because the losses are 105 million. And then each 3-year cycle go 104, 104, 104, 104, because then it would all add up. And you get to a position where with Manchester United, they've ended up saddling a debt of a billion. And obviously that's way over 105 million of losses, but not within a 3-year monitoring cycle. So maybe there's a logic, if we're to stick with PSR, that there should be two allowable losses, one projected over a fixed 10-year period to stop constant saddling of debt, and another over a rolling 3-year period to stop unsustainable spending over a shorter period of time. And I think that that's a very valid argument.
Okay, Stephen Kennedy was in early. He says, Ben, do you think Chelsea's Saudi investors will help them out of a hole by taking players from them to the Saudi league for inflated fees? And another question Stephen asked was, Ben, do you know if Bournemouth had a lot of injuries when Eddie and his team were working there?
Yeah, I don't think they had a great deal of injuries, but it was a shoestring budget and it was a smaller squad. And Howe obviously did very well there. I'm not familiar with their injury list during his time. I think these particular Newcastle injuries will be investigated to make sure that there's nothing the club are missing. But there's obviously been an element of bad luck as well. With Chelsea and Saudi investors, there are technically no Saudi investors working for Chelsea. That's the first thing to say. Clear Lake Capital and PIF have got a relationship. We know that, but a lot of the Chelsea business to Saudi Arabia was done by centralized Ministry of Sport deal makers, not directly PIF, even though the players went to PIF controlled clubs. And if you look at the fees, they were not spectacular in any way. It's kind of funny how people said Chelsea are offloading players like Kalidou Koulibaly or Edouard Mendy to Saudi Arabia and they're benefiting dramatically. But those fees were reasonably low. And then N'Golo Kante was a free transfer that Chelsea didn't want to lose. And Romelu Lukaku never went. And Raheem Sterling didn't want to go. And ultimately, it was in the interests of Saudi Arabia to get these stars and the players wanted to go. But I don't think the fees were crazy. The craziest or the biggest fee in that summer that Chelsea received was from Arsenal for Kai Havertz, which can rise to somewhere in the region of 70 million. And imagine if Saudi Arabia had paid for Havertz for 70 million and Koulibaly and Mendy had gone to Premier League clubs, then there would have been absolute outrage. But somehow, because it was Arsenal buying Kai Havertz, no one says, oh, Arsenal bailing Chelsea out. It's just Arsenal want Havertz, Arsenal buy Havertz. Maybe a few eyebrows were raised about the fee. But in fairness, Havertz is kind of growing into that fee at the moment because he's in excellent form and fair play to him. But everyone's focused on the Saudi side. And the truth is, most of these Saudi fees are not really dramatically bailing out clubs. They're modest and they're at fair market value. Everyone had a big free for all about Alan St. Maximum as well. And that fee was relatively market value and modest as well. So I don't think it's a case of Chelsea gaining an advantage. I think lots of clubs are realizing that Saudi is not a threat so much as a solution. And in the same way that Chelsea were able to offload two or three, I think this coming summer, we're going to see Manchester United potentially do the same with the likes of Varane, Wan-Bissaka, Casemiro, Martial. There's Saudi interest in all of them. Let's see how many of them want to go. Even Sancho, there's historical interest in as well. So Saudi's there. And of course, if you can sell to Saudi, it's great because Saudi will often go to club, not agent first. So you might be able to line up four or five at once because they'll visit the club and say, who's available? And can we do some kind of bulk deal? And that's just the unique way that they do business. But in hindsight, I don't look back and think that Chelsea gained an advantage. As I said before, I think the best fee that Chelsea got that summer was the Havertz fee with him going to Arsenal. And for some reason, nobody's mentioning that. And Chelsea have been helped financially more because of that than the collective deals they did with Saudi Arabia.
Okay, the very last question was from JSO. Can you ask why all the questions from the media are about Bruno leaving? I don't see them asking other players at other clubs whilst playing for their country. Lots of conjecture around Bruno potentially leaving. What's your thoughts? Why are Newcastle's star players being heavily linked with moves?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, when players do international duty, they often go in front of the press and they maybe do less press conferences for their clubs, so these questions get asked. I think Newcastle fans may think that that's the narrative, but Kylian Mbappe went in front of the press yesterday and was also asked about his future. You may remember heading into the World Cup, Declan Rice went in front of the press and said he envies his international teammates playing Champions League football. And at that point, he was asked about his future as well. Georgi Sudakov went in front of the press for Ukraine and was asked about his future because the rumour is that Arsenal might make a bid. So lots of players during the international break have been asked about his future. I think because it's England against Brazil, it's normal that this will be a narrative and therefore Bruno Guimarães will be one person that is spoken about. But I don't think this is only Newcastle. All of us, to be honest, as journalists, if we're put in front of a player that's being linked with another club, we'll try and ask that player whether or not he plans to stay or go, whether he's happy, whether he might entertain a move, whether he's got aspirations to move elsewhere. Ivan Toney did an interview with Sky a couple of weeks ago and joked that he wanted to join Real Madrid. So in the last 2 weeks alone, I've seen lots and lots of players asked about their future. And I don't think that this is a Newcastle United agenda. I think if you're a Newcastle United fan, you're more inclined to see Newcastle stories in the media and on social media. So you maybe think it's that way. But I remember when Maddison and Barnes were outgoing from Leicester, if they were put in front of the media. They were also asked about their futures as well. Gareth Southgate yesterday went in front of the media and was asked whether or not he would consider joining Manchester United. So there's a pattern here, which is that when media feel there's a story and a player or a manager are available in a press conference or a one-on-one, the questions get asked. Then I think generally Newcastle do just have players that are sellable assets. So if under profit and sustainability they need to sell, there may be a situation where there is more buzz around outgoings. We know that Almiron will be sold at the right price if he's willing to leave. He didn't want to go to Al-Shabaab, but that didn't stop negotiations between PIF and Al-Shabaab and getting to the point of a 30 million euros verbal agreement. And then atypically, the player wasn't approached. And then when he was approached, he said, I don't want to go. And Newcastle said, fine, but he's still available. I think there'll be interest in Isak because of his form. I don't think Newcastle will want to sell. Bruno Guimaraes has got a release clause, so it's normal that he's asked about it. Kieran Trippier was interested in Bayern, but was respectful to Newcastle. If they feel that summer's the right time to sell, then he might be prepared to leave. Botman's in great form. Why wouldn't there be interest in him? So teams might try and capitalise on Newcastle's financial situation, but I don't think it's an agenda against Newcastle United. I think every self-respecting journalist doing their job, if they're put in front of a player where there's links with a move away, will end up asking that player about the situation, because if we don't, we're not doing our job.
Great stuff, Ben, as always. Thanks for your insight. Just want to say good luck to Newcastle women's team today, playing in their cup final. Very best wishes to them. 3,000 fans travelling down as well. That's a great effort down to Luton for the cup final. But Ben, as always, wonderful insight. Look forward to seeing you again very soon. And good luck to Leicester in their battle against...
Fingers crossed.
Take care, mate.
Have a good weekend.